Support for Faith Matters comes from the law offices of Mullen, Hoard, and Brown, LLP, offering a full range of legal services to regional and national clients. Mullen, Hoard, and Brown are members of ALFA International. More information is available at 765-7491 or mullenhoard.com.
Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center, home of the Joint Ranch. Covenant provides a place where hip and knee patients come together for pre-surgery educational classes and then reconvene post-surgery for group therapy and rehabilitation. Now here's the host of Faith Matters, Tom McGovern.
I'm Tom McGovern, host of Faith Matters, and it's my delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our special guest Dr. Rebecca Sleeper Irons. Rebecca is professor of pharmacy practice in the area of geriatrics, taking care of us older folk. And then in addition, she's associate dean for curriculum. Rebecca, as my friend, it's a delight to have you here this Sunday afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Chatting before we came on air, you said you were born in Massachusetts and you're the first of your family to come to the Southwest.
That's correct.
Born where?
Worcester, Massachusetts, central Massachusetts.
You come of a very wonderful historic lineage. Tell us who you're descended from.
Well, my family first arrived on the Mayflower in 1620, so every generation has been in Massachusetts for about the last 400 years.
So you're the first to venture forth?
My sisters and I, yes, are one of the first generations to leave New England.
Rebecca, thinking about the Mayflower, take us back to Bristol in the early 1600s. Recreate, if you will, for us, the voyage that brought your original ancestors to this country.
Well, the woman that I would like to speak about, her name is Susanna, and she was a young wife and mother at the time she boarded that boat. Her husband's name was William. Her five-year-old son, Resolved, and her soon-to-be second child on the way stepped onto the Mayflower in 1620 to make that voyage. There actually were two boats. They went from England to the Netherlands and then from the Netherlands to the New World. They were not that far into their journey, however, when the second boat, the Speedwell, began taking on water. They had to make a decision whether they were going to turn back or keep going, and they made the decision to keep going. So 104 people crammed onto a boat designed to carry half as many. That set up the journey that she would take. I can only imagine what that was like. They were crammed, they were malnourished, they were sick, and she was pregnant.
Tell us about where they originally came and the up and down the Cape looking for a place to land.
Well, their destination was Virginia. They never were intending to come to New England, but they were off course. They landed originally at the very tip of Cape Cod, the community of Provincetown, and they dropped anchor there. Susanna gave birth to her second son, Peregrine, while they were at anchor in Provincetown Harbor. The landing parties came ashore and they explored the outer Cape looking for fresh water. At the time, their provisions were running so low. They did have an initial encounter with a local native tribe that wasn't exactly friendly. I find it funny today, having vacationed on Cape Cod as a child, to think that they found the conditions of the Outer Cape unsuitable for a settlement.
Coveted property, no.
That's true. They got back on the boat and they tried to make it south to their destination of Virginia. As they tried coming around the southern arm of Cape Cod, between Nantucket and the coast, it was rocky and it was uncharted and they were afraid they were going to run asunder. So they turned around and they went back into the relative shelter of Massachusetts Bay. And that's where they ultimately landed at Plymouth. One of the things that I didn't appreciate until I started looking into the history was this was a hired boat. It was going to leave them there. They were left to the wilderness where there was no settlement to greet them and they had to construct it. And it's winter. It's now December. That first winter was harsh. They called it the Great Dying. Her husband, William, died, and she's now one of only four women that survived the winter, the only widow, and she's nursing an infant and taking care of a five-year-old son. So at that point, she had to marry because she couldn't own property as a male citizen could. So she married Edward Winslow, who was the spiritual leader of the community, and she became Susanna White Winslow. he took the boys in, raised them, taught them to read. The rest is history.
At this point, I'd like to acknowledge the wonderful work that your mother has done on this. Tell us about your mother.
My mother, Susan, did all of the legwork to document the family ancestry. And she did this quietly at first. She didn't tell the family that she was documenting this. To register the family with the Mayflower Society, it requires birth certificates, death certificates, and marriage certificates for every generation. And you have to get those from the individual county clerk's office where those events are registered. So she put a lot of miles on the car, going to all of the different places to obtain those records and ultimately get the family documented. When that happened, she surprised us all. And in 2010, our whole family converged on Plymouth in a family reunion of sorts to go and visit Pilgrim Hall and the replica of the Mayflower and Plymouth Plantation. I remember visiting Plymouth Plantation as a child. And I do remember that the individuals there dress in period clothing. They speak in Old English. But what I didn't know at the time was that every single one of those individuals has a character dossier of a real person who would have lived there circa 1627, so about 7 years after the Mayflower would have landed. That meant that Resolved would have been 12, Peregrine would have been 7, Susanna would have been married to Edward by that point. And my daughter and I immediately started going through the plantation looking for Susanna, and we found her. And I do have a wonderful family picture with my mother and my children and this woman who I know is an actress, but was portraying Susanna.
What a magnificent woman, and what a magnificent story you tell of her.
I think when I first started thinking about her story, history was able to tell me the facts of her life. I was able to know the events that happened to her. But it required an exercise in empathy to really imagine what those experiences felt like, what they must have been like to live through. For me, I found that to be a very enlightening exercise. Of course, I can only speculate about what it felt like, but I wonder, did she ever regret her choices? Could she have known what the future generations would have become as a result of the life that she lived? She couldn't have known that at the time, but yet I wouldn't be here if her life had not unfolded the way that it did. There's something very profound that you have to respect. And the fact that she and her husband took this risk, this leap of faith, they struck out into the unknown, they brought their children to do it, and it didn't turn out the way she expected it to. I have never experienced anything on a level of what Susanna would have experienced. But at any time in our lives we've ever taken a risk and it didn't work out the way we wanted it to, or we were even contemplating taking a risk and worried about whether or not it would succeed, it's a very interesting parallel to think about the story of someone who came before us.
See, that's the beautiful gift that she has given to you and the generations that came after her. I was very impressed, Rebecca, when you were describing the strange, call it God's providence, if you will, but the mystery of life and the unfolding of life in the unknown of your original ancestor. From which of them are you descended?
From William and Susanna, their 5-year-old son, Resolved. He was the 5-year-old when they boarded the boat. So the baby that was born in Provincetown Harbor, his name was Peregrine. So he would be like a distant uncle. Resolved would grow up to marry Judith Fassel, who I believe was the daughter of the owner of the boat. It's 9 generations after that. We get to me.
Listen, at this point, can we take a short break? We'll come back to continue this fascinating story. Thank you.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center. More information on customized plans for joint replacement surgery is at covenanthealth.org/ortho.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. This Sunday afternoon, it's our delight to have as our guest Dr. Rebecca Sleeper-Irons. And Rebecca, at the break, we're talking about these wonderful names, Resolved and Peregrine.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that Resolved was one who was resolved. And what did we decide Peregrine meant?
Peregrine is a type of bird, and it means traveler.
Peregrinus in Latin, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So both of their names, I feel, are very symbolic, given their situation in history.
Well, let's pick up your story. They're beginning to put down the roots of a settlement. The origins of the first Thanksgiving, reflect on that for a minute, since your family was involved in it.
The first Thanksgiving would happen the following year, in 1621. We know the story of Massasoit, who was the Wampanoag leader who befriended the early settlers and helped them. And their relationship is what led to the story that we know is the first Thanksgiving. The story that's a little less known is the story of Massasoit's son, Metacom, who was another leader in the Wampanoag Nation. As a beautiful story as the first Thanksgiving was, that wasn't exactly the tone of the relationship between the European settlers and the native peoples that ensued over the next several decades. By the 1670s, they were at war with each other. Metacom, who was Massasoit's son, he adopted the moniker King Philip. I don't know if a lot of people remember the story of King Philip's War. If we describe King Philip's War in terms of the proportion of casualties rather than the absolute number of casualties, it was actually the bloodiest in our history. About 3/4 of the European settlers that came died. There was disease and there was malnourishment and a lot of other things afflicting the early settlers in those early years. It was bloody, and there were conflicts from southern New England up to Maine. In the early 1670s that all of this really kind of came to a head, King Philip was ultimately killed in a raid led by Benjamin Church. The hostilities somewhat settled down after that, but it had left an ugly scar on the early history. In fact, I have another relative. My mother could tell you the exact connection to her. I cannot. But her name was Mary Rowlandson, and she was actually abducted in a rather famous story and ransomed back to her family at a place in central Massachusetts, which is now referred to as Redemption Rock.
Oh, how interesting. What date are we approximately at now?
1670s. And whisperings of witchcraft were nothing new to the community at that time. Witchcraft had been something that had been a scourge in Europe for 100 years. And in fact, thousands more people would die in Europe in relation to what happened in early New England.
Looking at the European experience of witchcraft, to what would you attribute this terrible event in history?
Depending on who was on the throne, it went back and forth between Catholicism and Protestant ruler. If you weren't on the right side of the crown, you were persecuted. And so there was a lot of pointing fingers from one denomination to another. And I also think witchcraft was always just one of those convenient scapegoats for the things that we feared that we couldn't explain.
And also whispering within the community that it was a very sinister way of dealing with people that you either disagreed or you might portray as your enemies.
Correct.
From this European phenomenon of witchcraft, which its own particular history, as you trace its origins, what outlines do you see? Perhaps the precursors and then when it came into full bloom.
Whisperings of witchcraft had gone on for decades before the hysteria even began. There are many historians that describe that as a punishment from God for not being pious enough. It was very easy for one member of the community to point a finger at another member of the community and say, "You got us into this mess because you are not a true believer." I know we like to think of those early ancestors on the Mayflower as seeking religious freedom. And they were. They went about setting up a church that was every bit as exclusive and oppressive as the one that they left. It was just a different church. And at the time, if you were Quaker, if you were Catholic, you just were not welcome in those early New England churches. It was us and them. Persecution of Quakers was well documented during those years. It would have been in the 1630s, 1640s that Roger William came to New England, looked around at Massachusetts and said, "Well, I don't get along here either," and decided to set up his own personal state. He founded the Baptist Church in Rhode Island and founded the state of Rhode Island. It was largely based on the fact that he came to the New World seeking religious freedom and didn't find it, so went to Rhode Island to set it up there.
So there was a climate of intolerance. In addition to King Philip's War, this climate of intolerance that affected all of the various communities, it was in this environment the American experience of witchcraft and the rest of the terrible history resulting from it began to take shape.
That's true. And as much as I think of myself as a daughter of Massachusetts, I also have ties to Rhode Island. I was a college student in Rhode Island, and I learned much about that state's history from my time there. And I've come to respect Roger Williams a great deal, too. It was his writings about true religious tolerance, not religious freedom so much, but religious tolerance, that became the underpinnings for what Thomas Jefferson would ultimately write about when he drafted the Constitution.
What do you think is more important, religious freedom or religious tolerance?
I think tolerance. I really do, based on my own experience.
And your own family history?
Yes.
Rebecca, we'll take a short break and we will continue this wonderful, fascinating conversation after this short break.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center. More information on customized plans for joint replacement surgery is at covenanthealth.org/ortho. The views, opinions, and comments that are expressed on this program are solely those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect or represent the views and opinions of KTTZ-FM, Texas Tech Public Media, Texas Tech University, Texas Tech University System, or our faculty and staff, our affiliates, our partners, and our sponsors.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm delighted this Sunday afternoon to have as our guest Dr. Rebecca Sleeper-Irons, my colleague from the School of Pharmacy at the Health Sciences Center. If you will set the scene now for us in terms of what was happening in the community that you're descended from at this particular time, in terms of particularly the witchcraft and the Salem experience, which we will get to.
This year actually marks the 325th anniversary of the Salem witch hysteria, 1692. I am descended from a woman who was accused and executed for witchcraft, and she was accused along with two of her sisters. Before that ever started, though, whisperings of witchcraft had existed in that community for a while, and their mother was even pulled in 2 decades earlier.
The original accusation, where did it get full resonance?
I mean, the story that we know in the 1690s started with some girls that started throwing fits and wailing and moaning and pointing fingers. This had a precedent that had already been set, townspeople whispering against each other. So this wasn't a new thing when it happened. In fact, their mother, her name was Joanna Blessing Town. When she was in her late 70s, she was, I think, 75 years old. She was at a dinner at the parsonage of their town, where some other dinner guests complained that the minister partook a little too much of the sacramental wine. Well, Joanna stood up for him. Joanna said, no, he did not, and she testified on his behalf. But she did so at the displeasure of the other guests at that dinner. And by invoking their ire, they started whispering about witch, witch. And that was really how you ostracized a member of the community who you were displeased with. Unfortunately, it was also thought that witchcraft was hereditary. When this hysteria broke in the next 22 years, it was really not sort of surprising that her daughters would get pulled into the hysteria. Joanna was never formally accused or put on trial or anything. It was rumors, ugly rumors. Years later, when the hysteria started, there's a lot of theories and there's been many books written about all of the different sources of the hysteria. I really think it came down to neighbor against neighbor hate. That's fundamentally what it seemed to be. There were your Salem families, your Salem Village families, and your Topsfield and Ipswich families, which are all kind of adjacent to each other. My ancestors were from Topsfield. Among the first 5 women to be accused was my 10th great aunt. Her name was Rebecca. Rebecca Town, nurse. Rebecca was 71 years old, a very respected member of the community. Her family was feuding with a Salem family, the Putnams. It was petty squabbles over land and border, and the Putnam men were cutting timber on the town family's land, and the magistrate upheld the town men instead of the Putnams. It was neighbor against neighbor animosity. So when Rebecca was accused, at first no one seriously thought that anything would happen, but she was found guilty. Sort of the incubus for all of this were some young girls. They were largely between the ages of 9 and 12. Some of them were a little older. And again, they would fall into fits and they would wail and they would pitch and they would scream and point fingers. The nexus of this was in the Putnam family household. When the girls pointed a finger at Rebecca Nurse in particular.
Now, where was she tried? In what setting?
There wasn't a court at the time. It was really religious elders that were making up the judge and jury. She was 71 years old at the time she was accused. She was elderly and frail, and she was deaf, and she could barely hear the charges against her. At first, actually, they did find her not guilty. As soon as the verdict was read, the girls just sort of melted into hysterics, wailing and crying and moaning, and the foreman was sent back to re-deliberate with the jury. What ultimately changed the verdict and got her convicted was what they called self-incriminating evidence. They hit on just a phrase that Rebecca had said, where she referred to another woman, Goody Hobbs, who had also been accused, as one of us. And so they questioned her, what did you mean by one of us? She didn't answer. Some historians have speculated that the reason she didn't answer was because she couldn't hear. But she didn't answer, and that was the linchpin on which the verdict hung. They switched to guilty, and she was executed by hanging. Later, she did submit in writing that when she said one of us, she meant a fellow accused, not a fellow witch, but it didn't matter. There were five women that were the first to be executed in 1692, and Rebecca was one of those five. She was a 10th generation great aunt. So then her sisters, which include Mary, Town, Eastie, and Sarah, they were also accused. It was only a matter of time. Their mother was a rumored witch, and now Rebecca was an executed witch. Mary and Sarah were now both accused.
Their trial would follow, and
one would die and one would survive.
Death by hanging, yes?
Yes.
Part of a public spectacle?
Yes.
My goodness. I really want us to continue next Sunday with a continuation of this story. Just of conclusion for today, as you reflect on the Mayflower, the early settlement, what strikes you as the most important lesson for you and for us from that period?
For Susanna, I think it is her courage and her tenacity. She took a risk and it didn't work out the way she wanted it to, but she had to make it work. She raised two boys. She remarried. She made it work. There's a lot to be said for accepting your circumstances and moving forward in a way that would be meaningful for the people that would come after you. And I am sure she railed against it. I don't know how she couldn't have, but I take away from her courage and tenacity.
For your sainted ancestor, the one that we described today, who died by false accusation, what would you take from her life?
Faith in the right and integrity, especially when we will talk about Mary. It's having faith in the right, even when you're being falsely accused.
Rebecca, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much on behalf of Chuck and myself for sharing it with us, and we'll continue our conversation next Sunday afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Medical Center, home of a full range of orthopedic services, including Joint Ranch. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1, a service of Texas Tech Public Media.